You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. I'm delighted now to welcome Caroline Fraser. She's author of the new book, Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder, which just won the Pulitzer Prize for Biography. Congratulations and welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. And the book is a fascinating biography of Laura Ingalls Wilder, but it's not only the story of this beloved author of Little House in the Big Woods, all the books in the Little House series about frontier life in the 19th century. It's also the story of colonialism, ecosystem destruction, and the resulting havoc of what the pioneers were doing, American boom-bust economies, the deepest arguments and animosities in American politics. First of all, how did you get interested in Laura Ingalls Wilder in the first place and come to write this book?
Well, it started a long, long time ago because I was a fan of her as a kid and read all the books more than once. I mean, I just kind of read them over and over again. I found them really engrossing and comforting, too. I think kids often have that response to them because they're so kind of warm. They depict this wonderful, warm family. There's all this kind of fascinating problem solving, you know, as the family is, you know, building their little houses and dealing with all kinds of natural disasters. And so I loved the books. And I also had a sense that they were tied in some way or reflective of my own family's experience, because I came from families that had all farmed in the Midwest and Wisconsin and Minnesota and the Dakotas. And so it was really, that part of it was really intriguing to me because I sort of felt like it kind of opened up that world of my grandparents. And I was constantly hearing sort of little stories from them about the kinds of things they had done as children, which were just unimaginable to me, you know, the kind of work that they had to do. So that was where I started. And then as an adult, I had an opportunity to write about Wilder for the New York Review of Books, reviewed a biography of Wilder's daughter, Rose, which was quite controversial and cast some doubts on Wilder's own authorship. So that was a really interesting experience. And some 20 years later, I was asked to write the notes for and edit the Library of America's edition of the Little House books. And that was really what gave me the idea of writing a new biography of Wilder.
Laura Ingalls Wilder was born in 1867 in Wisconsin, and her parents kept moving during her childhood. They were in Wisconsin, Kansas, Minnesota, Dakota territories. They were trying to make a living as farmers in what had been, and sometimes still was at that time, Indian land. They suffered one disaster after another, not because they didn't work hard, but because they were trying to do something that was virtually impossible on land that wasn't suitable for the kind of farming that they and so many others were out there trying to settle, trying to tame. How did that happen? How did they and so many settlers find themselves in that position? What was the incentive to get them out there?
Yeah, that's a kind of a fascinating question, especially with regard to the Ingalls family, because people who have read the first book in the Little House series, Little House in the Big Woods, that's all about Wisconsin and describes their farm in the woods, which was actually quite near the Mississippi River. And you can tell in that book that they're kind of doing okay, you know, that they have a garden, that Charles Ingalls, the father, is hunting, and there's plenty to eat. You know, the attic is full of all kinds of stored cheeses and meats, and so they're doing okay. And when you read those books as an adult, you read that volume, and then you go on to the next ones. The third volume, Little House on the Prairie, the most famous of the series, is set in Kansas. And you wonder, gee, why did these people leave this safe haven? And I think that the answer to that is we don't entirely know. Records suggest that they were having some difficulties in making enough money to support themselves year to year. I mean, a lot of these farmers were essentially very much on the edge, subsistence farming. And if they couldn't put together enough money to buy seed or supplies for the next year, they would end up borrowing. And that's what Charles Ingalls did. And I think he had the opportunity to sell for a fairly good price his land. And he also just had clearly a very restless side to him. And there was a sense that he was always looking for something better, a bigger break in terms of being able to sell. So I think that that was what happened. There was no railroad in Wisconsin at that time where they were living. And so that may have played into it. He may have been looking for land closer to a railroad because that would have made it easier for him to sell wheat crop, for example, which was kind of what everybody was groping for, was the big breakthrough wheat crop that was going to sell for a lot of money and put you in a better place financially. So we don't exactly know, but I think that that's kind of what happened. And once he'd done that, it became a very fateful decision, I think, for the family's future, because then they were increasingly moving out onto land that was, as you were mentioning, just really less and less suitable for farming.
Well, they were part of a whole movement which was very much promoted for quote-unquote settling the land. And one of the things that you write about in the book is that in one of the Little House books, the author says, you know, the narrator says, we went out onto this land and there were no people there.
Right.
But of course, there were lots of people there.
Yeah, that's a famous assertion that comes up more than once, actually, in the series. And in part, that was a reflection of her recollection as a very young child. You know, when they went to Kansas, she was actually 3, although in the book, she's portrayed as a little bit older. But yes, she often makes that assertion, and in part that is related to events that had just happened or were happening on the Great Plains. She was born 5 years after a very famous event called the Minnesota Massacre, which was an extraordinarily dramatic and terrifying event when the Dakota, several bands, one in particular of the Dakota in Minnesota, decided to go to war against the U.S. government because of treaty violations. And they didn't, as was their custom, they didn't announce this ahead of time. They just attacked one morning and over the course of just a few days killed possibly around 600 white settlers in Minnesota, which was an event that they were, you know, of course, ultimately defeated in various battles that followed that in 1862. But the upshot of that was that the Plains Indian Wars began in earnest, and most Indians, even if they weren't Dakota, were forced out of Minnesota. What was happening to them was happening to the Osage Indians in Kansas when the Ingalls family arrived. The Osage were really being forced out by a huge number of settlers who had poured into the region in the hope that the government would essentially take the land from the Indians and give it to them, which was, of course, ultimately what happened. But all of that happened in a way that made her feel, I think, that especially when she was first, you know, a very young child in Wisconsin, there weren't very many Indians around because of those events. I'm not sure how much she connected this in her own mind, but she was certainly aware of the Minnesota Massacre because it comes up at various very dramatic moments in Little House on the Prairie.
And you describe it in some detail in the book, and of course it's harrowing, but there's reasons behind it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were treaty violations, they were being kicked off of land that they knew, and the deep problem with this is that these people who were indigenous to this land were being kicked off land that they knew how to use and were being replaced by people who were making every mistake you could possibly make.
Right.
And
yeah,
why, like, how do we understand that? Was it government policy?
It's a terrible irony because, of course, now reading about the way of life, for example, of the Dakota in Minnesota, they had a very sensible system worked out that took into account the limitations of various areas, so that they did some agriculture in areas where that was appropriate. They grew corn next to rivers and so forth. They gathered wild rice. Then they would move over the winter up into areas where they would hunt. So they really had a whole system worked out that made sense on an ecological perspective. And of course, when the white settlers came in, they didn't know about this. They didn't understand it. They didn't want to understand it. They had no interest really in learning about that, and basically saw the only system that they knew was to settle on land and farm it continuously, which in some cases would prove fairly disastrous because of very heavy demands on the land. They were also moving into an area that had, not so much in Minnesota, but when they went out onto the Great Plains of the Dakota Territory, they were moving into an area that had very uncertain precipitation that occurred very randomly and often in forms that were not friendly to growing wheat. And there were also grasshoppers. Grasshopper plagues were well known in that area. That was one of the reasons why farmers hadn't gone out there to begin with. And of course, the government knew this and the railroad people knew this, but by the late 1870s, early 1880s, there was so little viable land left at affordable prices for homesteaders who wanted to try to do the whole government program and get the land for free by proving up on it over 5 years. They just decided to throw these people out there essentially and see what would happen. I think that the government knew very well that this would not prove to be sustainable. But it was a boon to the railroads because the railroads got to build more lines out west and charge freight rates for all the people who were moving out there. That's how people moved their stuff out there. That's how they moved freight when they grew crops. And they ended up having a couple of good years, and then things went downhill.
Partly because they ripped out the types of grasses that actually held the soil together.
Right. Yes. I mean, this is a really striking phenomenon. When I was writing my previous book about rewilding and conservation, I saw this extraordinary photograph from Australia that showed one of those rabbit-proof fences that goes for miles. It's like somebody took a piece of chalk and drew it across the landscape. And on one side of that fence, there was wheat. On the other side, there was native vegetation. And on the side with the wheat, there are no clouds. This was taken from a plane. It's just baking under the sun. On the other side of the fence with the native vegetation, there's clouds. There's shade. Those plants were transpiring and creating their own kind of microclimate. And so you can see from that photograph, which was part of a scientific paper about how we alter the climate when we do agriculture.
Right.
It speaks for itself. And it shows that what the settlers did when they went out in the Great Plains was kind of that same experiment. They ripped off the grass. They ripped off these plants that were transpiring and maintaining some kind of stability. And all of a sudden, you know, they're planting all this wheat, which is a fairly thirsty crop, and the result was a pretty severe drought.
So this is the 19th century version of human-created climate change.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that it is, because what happened in the 1890s was very severe drought across the upper Great Plains, which exactly mirrors the situation you had a few decades later in the Dust Bowl in the 1930s.
Now, John Wesley Powell was a scientist, and he was director of the U.S. Geological Survey around this time, and he had a very clear understanding of Western lands and how they could be most productively used. he wasn't listened to. Mm-hmm. What was his understanding? Like, what was he suggesting?
Well, he was, Powell was a great explorer. I mean, he was a guy who had gone and explored many river systems in the West, and he had seen something that the Mormons were trying out in Utah, which was a much more cooperative model, which involved sharing water, which is, of course, also what happens in New Mexico and has happened here for generations. The water supply is so limited that people had to evolve a way of sharing and distributing water through acequias. The Mormons were doing this too up in Utah through canals and so forth. And it was clear to him, having seen both the limitations of the climate out west and these systems, that something like that was going to need to be practiced in the Great Plains. And so that the Homestead Act was fairly limited in terms of the size of what they gave out. It was 160 acres. And Powell looked at that and said, you know, that's too small. For anything like this to work, you're going to have very large-scale irrigation practiced cooperatively, and you're going to have to increase the size of homesteads in this area, in the Great Plains. And he was basically kind of shouted down by people in Congress and so forth who were lobbyists, essentially, for the railroads. And so it was clear that that cooperative model was going to interfere with the amount of money that could be made by the railroads. So unfortunately, he lost out on that. And it certainly, from hindsight, would have been a much wiser model to pursue.
So many of the things that happen in this book are so familiar. I mean, when you think about lobbyists for commercial interests dominating scientific knowledge, you know, or having their interests win out over what scientists are saying is true. I mean, so much of this rings true today. It's a different scenario on some level. It's a different scale. But really, the scale of disasters that happened to the folks like Laura Ingalls Wilder's family was so huge. And some of the greatest natural disasters that I'd never heard of, like this locust grasshopper infestation, describe to us what that was like and what the scale of that infestation was and what it did to farmers like Ingalls.
Yeah, that was an extraordinary chapter in her life. And of course, she wrote about it in her books. There's a sort of beautiful description of it, which is still used, I think, by scientists and sociologists who study this phenomenon, because it's a beautiful description of what happened. And yet I think she herself did not know the scale of it, because she, of course, was just limited to their experience and their area. They were living north of the town of Walnut Grove in Minnesota, and it was a locust plague that played out over a number of years. And locusts, of course, are basically just grasshoppers. They're no different than grasshoppers, except that locust species have this ability to swarm in large numbers and travel sort of incredible distances. And that's what happened in the 1870s, is that there was an outbreak very associated probably with drought and high heat, because that favored the species. So all of a sudden there were millions, billions. Now they believe that there were on the order of something like 3 trillion insects that were flying in this massive swarm that covered essentially this entire central area of the United States, from the Canadian border all the way down to Texas. And so there are eyewitness accounts of this from Wilder herself and from other farmers in Kansas and Nebraska. And it was just, I think it must have been terrifying. We don't really have any photographs, because there just wasn't the capability to kind of capture a phenomenon like that with photography at that time. So we just have to kind of imagine it from the descriptions, which are horrifying.
Clouds of these insects covering areas the size of states.
Yeah, it's almost unbelievable. And there's great documentation of this, because the government did assign a scientist and a team of people to study it and try to figure out what could be done. Really, in the end, nothing could be done, that there was no technological fix for this. They tried all kinds of crazy things, you know, setting fires and using these contraptions that they would drag across fields that were, you know, covered with tar. They would try to collect them. But in the end, it just had to play out. And the fascinating upshot of it all was that later on, within Charles Ingalls' lifetime, the species that swarmed the Rocky Mountain locust ended up going extinct for reasons that are still not entirely understood, but may have to do with the wholesale land clearing that was going on. And that left, you know, the fact that this species disappeared from the continent where there were no other swarming locusts, left the United States in this incredibly fortuitous space economically, because it left us as the only major wheat producing continent that did not have a swarming locust. Europe had them, Australia had them, Africa had them, and still do. So there were ramifications of this beyond what Laura Ingalls Wilder could ever have imagined. But of course, when she wrote her account of this, it was in the 1930s during the Dust Bowl, and there was another localized grasshopper outbreak in the region where she lived in Missouri. And I think that that totally reminded her and sort of re-experienced the trauma of that whole thing because it was happening again.
Well, I mean, it's such an irony that when this particular grasshopper locust species went extinct, it gave us an agricultural advantage that resulted in the Dust Bowl.
Yes. Yes, there's some terrible irony in there that it's just astounding. And it was astounding for the family, too, because, of course, if they had stayed in Wisconsin, this wouldn't have happened to them.
Where they didn't have locusts.
Right, right.
Well, and I think what's so interesting about it, I remember watching Ken Burns' documentary on the Dust Bowl, and of course the human pain that and the trauma that people went through and the locust infestations and all these things, which really to the people there must have seemed like the wrath of God, but they were very much human made disasters. And I wonder if Laura Ingalls Wilder ever really knew that.
Yeah, that's an interesting kind of intriguing thing to think about, because on the one hand, I think she did see what people did to the land. She never loved town life. She didn't like being in town as a young girl. She loved being out on the prairie where there weren't a lot of people. She often wrote kind of disparagingly of the kind of dirty quality of towns. And wrote eloquently and lyrically about these beautiful vistas in the wilderness that she loved. And so I think she saw a connection in a small way. I'm not so sure that she saw the whole picture, and it would have been hard at that time to see it with the kind of education that she had. And yet she also knew that, you know, that she wasn't really successful as a farmer. I mean, they farmed all their lives, and it was always a struggle. I think she loved the lifestyle that it allowed them to live in these beautiful places, but I think she also saw something of how unsustainable it was on a small scale.
And she also loved the wilderness itself and the animals, and she didn't like monocropping, and I think she said at a certain point that if she were an Indian, she would have scalped people too.
Yes, she did make this extraordinary statement as they were leaving the Dakota Territory that she said, if I had been an Indian, I would have scalped more white folks before I ever would have left it, which is a really kind of shocking remark from a white woman in 1894.
So all of these disasters were kind of a setup by commercial interests, by the government that promoted the Homestead Act, And the people who played this out were kind of the victims of this setup, and yet the government itself, state, federal, really didn't take any responsibility for what they'd basically created, and then offered very little help when the inevitable crises occurred.
Yeah, that's one of the really striking things that seems very familiar now, that having done this to people, having encouraged people to go out into an area that was going to be really unworkable for them, they then just basically folded their hands and were not just quiet about it either, but actively blamed the victims, you know, basically said, these farmers are lazy and just don't want to work hard. And it became this very kind of ugly situation where the governor of Minnesota and various other officials were just telling people that it was their own problem and that they could eat grasshoppers if they were hungry. I mean, it's really extraordinary, the rhetoric that comes out. And yet when you look at what happens today, we see much of that same rhetoric playing out again, often in different circumstances. You know, I think it reflects something about attitudes that have been present in this place since before it was a country.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people, the Puritans who came here had very harsh views about themselves and others, and ultimately, I think, established this pattern of blaming people for things that were not under their control.
It's sort of a rule of thumb for me. When any group calls any other group lazy, if you look at it hard, almost always you see that those are the hardest working people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And as I was reading this book, I mean, I was thinking about how little I know of deprivation and having to really survive. I mean, we are surrounded by food and stuff and people and all kinds of safety nets. I've never been cold and hungry and poor and out on the land the way these pioneers were. I mean, not even close. And this, for them, cultivated a deep ethic of self-reliance. But then you have to think, and so, you know, they talk about self-reliance, and also the politicians that were telling them they're not going to give them any relief said, you should have self-reliance. But they felt that way themselves. So it's sort of complicated. And then I was thinking, like, what does self-reliance even mean? Like, what is the unit of self in self-reliance? Like, no one person can survive alone. That's pretty obvious. A family like the Ingalls couldn't really quite do it unless they were lucky or had a lucky year or something. And a bit later in their lives, the survival was helped by being part of a larger group, a community, the Masons. There was even some governmental support. How do you understand this pioneer ethic of self-reliance and its sort of complexities and ironies?
Yeah, it is really a complicated topic and clearly played out in a very complex way in Laura Ingalls Wilder's life, because as a child, she's seeing her parents struggle and, you know, they were a family that sometimes didn't have enough to eat and experienced real poverty. Charles Ingalls struggled to put together some kind of way of providing reliably for his family, and the farming was not doing it, you know, so not by itself. And so he often had to take on other jobs, and her life mirrors that totally. You know, she is a farm wife and is working every day. You know, when in Missouri, she had a very successful chicken business, raising chickens and selling eggs and so forth. And yet that wasn't even enough, because you have to have some kind of cash economy for doctors and so forth. Often these crises that the family experienced, both when she was a child and later as an adult, were because of having to pay doctors. That debt was really a problem for all these people, because you needed cash to tide you over. You needed some kind of, you know, savings, and these people had no savings, you know. So she, you know, is on the one hand preaching self-reliance. You see this in her letters to her daughter. You know, she criticizes her neighbors and their handyman who kind of helped them take care of the property, for not doing enough and not ever having enough money. And yet I think there is a sneaking awareness in her of how unfair that is, because of course the whole thing had happened to her as well. And I think she recognized that what she was saying was harsh, but she couldn't help it in a way because she was so driven to feel that she had some control over her life by having this kind of value of having, you know, believing that she had been able to make it through self-reliance. But in fact, I think it was just much more complicated than that. And of course, by the end of her life, she's fairly well off. But that money came from her books. It came from writing
right.
about the farm, not from the farm.
Exactly. It's so interesting. One of the things that I thought was so cool in your book was you described some of the cultural legacies that came from that time and place, like tales of haunted houses. Well, that came from during bust cycles, these houses were abandoned. And right. so, you know, you have the Wizard of Oz.
Oh, right. Yeah, I was fascinated to learn that, you know, we always think of it as Kansas. But in fact, L. Frank Baum didn't live in Kansas, didn't know very much about Kansas. And the whole thing was from came from his experience of living only about 100 miles north of where the Wilders were trying to farm just after they got married. And so he experienced that same drought, that same mass exodus out of Dakota Territory that was taken by so many farmers who washed out at that time.
Another thing that was happening around that time was the beginning of women's rights, including women's property rights. How did that come to being and how did that play out?
Yeah, that was a very kind of late realization of mine that came from the fact that I had gone to the courthouse in Wright County in Missouri where Wilder lived. She and her husband had gone there in 1894 after failing in Dakota Territory. They went to this kind of promised land in the Ozarks, which had been touted by the railroad as the land of the Big Red Apple. And it was, in fact, at that time, quite a great area for orchards. And they bought a piece of property, which is this whole story of how they bought it has become part of the legend of Laura in a way, because she had supposedly had a $100 bill hidden in this little lap desk as they made the journey down there. And then the $100 bill was lost. They thought they couldn't find it. Fortunately, a few days later, they were it had slipped into some kind of crack and they found it. In fact, the story is a little more complicated because the land cost something around $400. They had 200 and something to put down on it, but the only name on the deed is Laura's name. And that to me was shocking because in what universe in 1894 does a woman buy property just under her own name?
When she's married with a child,
you know, and I was like, well, how could this be? Why would that have happened? And then I was kind of digging around and ultimately I thought maybe there might be some tax reason or something that they did this way. It turns out that there were all these local and state regulations that had been passed as a result of previous economic crises in which married women, because they owned no property, if their husbands went bust or, you know, spent all the money, the wives and their children would end up out on the street because they had no property rights. They had nothing in their own name. And so there was this whole movement, not really feminist in any way. It wasn't really about women's rights per se, but it was an attempt by politicians to create some kind of fallback so that if the property was in the woman's name alone, then the creditors, her husband's creditors, could not take it. So it was a way to try and protect women and children from the husband's creditors. And I have to think that that was why Laura's name turns up on several deeds, not just the one in the Ozarks. And I think that that was because El Manzo had gotten into considerable trouble.
Her husband.
In debt. Yes, El Manzo Wilder.
Now, something like that, I guess the unintended consequences of laws like that are that women start to then actually own property and actually want more rights and see themselves as empowered. And certainly Laura Ingalls Wilder and her daughter Rose were very strong, capable women with a lot of leadership ability. Did they embrace women's rights as a thing, like in suffrage, stuff like that?
Yeah, that's kind of complicated too, because when you read, you know, Wilder had a farm column for a number of years and wrote every other week she would write a column. And mostly these were aimed at farm women like herself and often talked about all kinds of ways to work more effectively or how to raise your chickens and stuff like that. But sometimes she would get into politics and issues around the vote, because of course this was all happening while she was writing the column. And she was quite sort of concerned about it and dubious about women's suffrage, I think because she feared some of the consequences socially. She was quite conservative socially and ultimately politically as well. And I think she was very concerned about issues like prohibition, which I believe she was in favor of for quite a number of years. So she had some real doubts about whether women should have the vote and what would happen once they did. So she wasn't actively opposed to it, but I think she was worried about it. And you can see this playing out in ways between her and her daughter, because her daughter was a completely different creature. Rose was very much a kind of bohemian, a sort of, you know, new woman, they called it in the early part of the century, and really, you know, just took off. She graduates from high school and goes off to Kansas City by herself, becomes a telegrapher, gets into all kinds of different business things, sells real estate, ends up working for newspapers in San Francisco. And I think Laura was both deeply impressed by her daughter's ambition and energy and success and the money she was making. On the other hand, she was horrified by some of the looser morals that she saw her daughter embrace.
And her daughter ended up being an extremely conservative libertarian who preached the ethic of self-reliance even as she was spending money like it was going out of style and was very irresponsible in certain ways. And she's her own kind of piece of work, yeah, person. And as you said, biographies have been written about her. But getting back to Wilder, I mean, she was writing this farm column and then she started writing the Little House books that are still classics and read by children in innumerable languages all around the world. And these books are kind of a, I guess you would call it a fictionalized memoir. Is that right?
Yes. The question of what they are is interesting because they're so unusual. I think they've been around for so long and we've gotten so used to them that we've kind of forgotten how unique they are, because essentially they are a fictionalized autobiography written in the third person. I mean, how many autobiographies are written in the third person by the person who lived their own life? I mean, it's a very unusual genre choice. And in fact, there's hardly anything else like it in a way. I think that that may have sort of come out of Rose's exposure very early on to yellow journalism. She got her start writing for the Bulletin, which was heavily influenced and ultimately owned by William Randolph Hearst, and started out doing these really crazy celebrity biographies. One of the first ones she wrote was she pretended to be Charlie Chaplin, and wrote his autobiography as if she knew what had happened to him. I think it was entirely concocted out of, you know, it was a clip job written from other articles about him. But when you look at the genre of that and then look at what her mother did, it shows a kind of fascination with just the flexibility of genre, of just, you know, okay, well, I want to write about my life, but I don't want to write about certain things. I don't want to write about the sad things. Laura was very resistant to anything that cast her father in a bad light, anything that was sort of sad or random or aimless in their lives. She just cut all that out, and she made a narrative that ultimately stressed a progressive quality to their lives, which I think in reality wasn't there.
Well, this is what's so interesting about these books. There are certain details that we know are inaccurate, like, okay, she was 3 years old, not 5 years old, and going from point A to point B, you know, some of that stuff was changed a little bit. Okay, whatever. But there are much bigger truths that are told and also big truths that are concealed in these books. And so, like, are they a mythologizing of the frontier past? Do they give an accurate sense of place? Some of both? Like, how do you pick that apart, and how do you understand it?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to look at what she chose to leave in and what she took out, because the books are fairly dark, you know, for children's novels. There's a lot of situations that are described, like the locusts and the blizzards and so forth, that are life-threatening. She was totally comfortable describing natural disasters, but she was not comfortable describing what happened with her father's farms and the failures that he experienced. So that all becomes a little murkier, you know, when you look at what he's doing in the novels. He becomes a real hero and this wonderful figure in the novels, which I think in many ways in real life he was. I think he was a great person and a great father in a lot of ways. But I also think that he didn't know entirely what he wanted to do. I think he was often grasping at sort of random jobs and just barely kind of making it. And all of that sort of sense of aimlessness and poverty disappears from the books. You never see Laura working in a hotel as she did in real life. You don't hear anything about her little brother. You know, scholars have pointed out that there's no death in the Little House books. Nobody dies.
Right, whereas in real life, her baby brother died.
Right, and in real life, she had a baby brother who died before he was 1 year old, so which was a huge trauma for the family. She did, of course, write famously about her sister's blindness. Mary goes blind in the novels, but that became a real battlefield with her daughter in terms of how to present that, because that was a very difficult time for the family, very chaotic time. And ultimately, it's presented in a way that leaves out a lot of that chaos.
And I can't help, because I'm always looking at things from the ecosystem perspective, I can't help thinking that if she and if the people around her, and I'm not saying that she should have, because that knowledge really probably wasn't there in the way that it is now, but if she had known what settlers like her dad and their family were doing to the land, it might not have been cast as, or there might not have been the conflict around dad's failures, because it wasn't him as an individual. You know, it's like the myth of Sisyphus, you know, you push a rock up the hill and it just comes sliding back down again. I mean, hard work in itself, without the bigger knowledge of what you're working at and what your odds are of success, it's sort of crazy. And this story, to me, illustrates that so profoundly.
Yeah, and I think ultimately, you know, she always said that she wrote these books to memorialize her parents. And I think she did that in a way that was profoundly satisfying to her and enabled her to sort of feel close to them again much later in her life when they were gone. And I'm not sure how much she intended, you know, to create this kind of wonderful, rosy view of American farming. But she did. And it has only been underlined and underscored and spread internationally by the television show, which followed long after she died.
Which took great liberties with the books.
Right, which took liberties with the books. But again, just sort of, you know, you find viewers of the show, you know, in Asia and all over the world, you know, and I think that they come away from the show feeling much the same, that this was this very heroic time in our history, when all the pioneers went out to the West and struggled and survived and created this incredibly fruitful farming empire. And again, it's a lot more complicated than that because, you know, if you look at statistics of small farmers today, they are struggling every bit as much as they were then.
And for a lot of the same reasons that have to do with both not really being cognizant of the ecosystems that they're in and working against them instead of trying to work with them, and the economic system that they were stuck in and didn't have any control over. I think it was so interesting to me reading this book, knowing that they were up in the Dakota Territories and having not only locusts, but hail and wind and all these other things that happened. And then seeing the present day story of Gabe Brown, who is in, you know, near Bismarck, North Dakota, and has this farm that he had 4 or 5 years of hail and of all these natural disasters, and finally said, you know what, I need to see this all in a new way, and started doing ecosystem-based farming, and is now like one of the poster children for regenerative agriculture.
Wow.
You know, so it's like there's a big cycle that's coming around now that regenerative agriculture is trying to correct those mistakes, I think. But this mythology of the traditional American farm that is still with us, that doesn't give us the full complexity of what these folks are living. I mean, it is such an interesting tale, I think, of the American experience and complexity. I mean, we have this love of land. We have this love of wilderness very much in us. We have this idealism, even as we're destroying this very land that we're idealizing. And we have deep conflicts about government and its purpose. We have this urban-rural divide, which doesn't have to be there, but it is. What did you learn about your own Americanness in the writing of this book?
Well, for one thing, I was deeply kind of shocked at how little there is about the history of farming in this country. There are some great definitive works, but there could be a lot more in terms of the amount of attention that's paid to these issues. I do think that is something that, you know, when you talk about the urban-rural divide, I think urban audiences are really interested in these issues of where the food is coming from and how healthy it is and sustainability. But there hasn't been, I think, enough attention paid to the history of what we've done about these issues in this country. And I would love to see more attention paid to that, because I think if we looked back at some of these eras, you know, and the decisions that were made, and really rethought what we're doing now according to the mistakes that we made then, we could avoid another Dust Bowl. We could ameliorate in some ways climate change. I mean, obviously we're on this track now that is going to be hard to swerve off of, but a lot could be done that needs to be done on an emergency basis. And so I think I came away from this book kind of shocked at how much we left unsaid and undone. You know, The Guardian just published recently a fascinating and really tragic article about suicide among farmers in America, which is really kind of an epidemic. And my family recently found out that my Swedish great-grandfather hung himself in his barn in like 1917 or something, you know. And I think that farming is so hard. It's so isolating. It's brutal work and conditions and hours, and the margins are so thin between success and failure that I think a lot more attention needs to be paid by society to the farm and farming, and really looking at monoculture and the costs of it, the costs of heavy use of fertilizer and pesticides and all of that stuff. And, you know, wow, we've really got a lot of work to do in that area.
And I think the wider context of that is learning from our mistakes, whatever those mistakes were, whether they be in farming, whether they be in politics, whether they be in the kind of balance between science and policy, things like that. We just keep doing the same things over and over again.
Yeah, and it's tragic when you look back at, you know, okay, 1894, and you see exactly what happens in the Dakotas. And Wilder and her daughter Rose wrote these incredible descriptions of seeing this line of people in covered wagons fleeing from the Dakotas in this vast kind of hellish dust cloud raised by these covered wagons fleeing from the region. And nothing is learned from that.
Right.
And then there's the Dust Bowl, because farmers, again, had this giant boom in the southern plains this time and destroyed a lot of land. And it was clear even as they were doing it. I mean, people said, you know, this is not good. This is not going to end well. And it happens again. And it's happening again now. I mean, we just went through a drought in the Southwest here that lasted, what, 10 years, 10, 12 years. We're, you know, moving into that again. We're going to end up living in that space because of what we've done to the climate.
And what is it about our minds, our way of seeing as Americans that's limited, that we seem not to be able to go outside of that and actually create new forms of ways to live that are more sustainable?
Well, that's maybe above my pay grade, but I think that is related in some way to just the profit motive, you know, that if people are just looking at the very short term of how much money they can make this year or next year without looking at the bigger picture and examining what the costs and the consequences are of decisions that they're making, you know, it adds up. It's catastrophic economically, as well as in many other ways, as well as socially. So we really do need to think in the longer term and look backwards as well as forwards.
And all of this is brought up by the life of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Caroline Fraser is author of the new book, Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. It's winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Biography. Once again, congratulations and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great talking about this.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.